So about 20 minutes before the call, I have to pick up and I have to call my boss and I say, I really messed up. I made a $20 million mistake and like, I don't know what to do.
Welcome to Re-Energize.
This is a podcast about renewable energy.
Yeah, we know what you're thinking. Another duo of clean tech bros wonking out on energy policy.
Think again. This is about your energy.
How do you find peace on the emotional roller coaster of renewable development? How has this work transformed you?
We ask these questions together with people who have lived it.
Plug in.
It's time to re-energize. So, Jackie, welcome to Re-Energize.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I think we're going to have Joel do an introduction to our audience.
Delightful.
So you can listen in and you can correct anything that he gets wrong. So Joel, you want to go ahead?
Today we have Jackie Chambers. Jackie, we're so grateful that you were joining us. Jackie is currently at New Energy Equity, which she joined in 2024. Prior to that, she spent well over a decade in the solar industry. And with that in mind, she brings a deep well of experience. In her current role, she is the CIO at New Energy Equity. She's responsible for shaping the long-term project finance and monetization strategy for New Equity's pipeline of projects. Prior to that, she spent time at PNC Energy Capital doing tax equity. She's been involved with behind the meter, rooftop mounts, utility scale, community solar, sale leasebacks, partnership flips, you name it. She also most recently was vice president of channel origination at NextAmp. So she has successfully closed over 300 megawatts of community solar projects, and she's been around the ring here. So we're very thankful to have Jackie with us today.
Thanks, Joel. Happy to be here.
Jackie, before we get into your story, just out of curiosity, how did you get into renewable energy to begin with?
Accidentally? How does one get into renewable energy?
Definitely not on purpose.
Accidentally? I ended up getting basically a request to come to PNC at the time, was doing, hiring like large classes of folks who were coming out of college because they were seeing a leadership gap within the organization based on, you know, the age of the folks who were in leadership positions and retirement planning and all that kind of good stuff. And so they would hire every year, I don't know, somewhere around 150 folks coming out of college with the intention of them hanging around the bank for a long time and basically giving everybody the same amount of level setting information when you joined the bank. So we all had sort of like the baseline amount of training. During that process, at the very initial stages, they say, okay, come in. And you do a round robin interview with like, I don't know, 10 different teams within the bank. And the leader of the respective team was looking to fill, you know, a role on their team. And they either liked you or they did not like you. And one of the individuals that I happened to interview with was the leader of the energy capital team, which was the renewable team. So I joined his team through, I think we called it the PNC Development Academy at the time. So I was looking for a job at the bank, and the job that I happened to get was on the renewables team. So
totally by accident.
Totally by accident. But it turned out I'm more of a totally more of a member of the renewables sector than I was ever a banker. I would sit there and I'm like, I'm not a banker. That's not me.
So that's awesome. I mean, maybe you just answered the question. So Jay asked how you got involved originally, and because your answer was by accident, I'm curious, why did you decide to stay involved?
Oh, I had too much fun. How do you get off the solar coaster? I had too much fun. It's you're up, you're down, you're in, you're out, you're developing projects, you're lending money. It's I really like learning. I really like information. I really like the continued challenge of the industry, and I feel like I have never been bored here. Even year to year, as things change at the political level, you know, there's always something happening here, and it's such a great community as well that I couldn't fathom leaving it.
Love that. That's awesome. Accidentally fell into it and fell in love with it. That's
mm-hmm.
really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So Jackie, before we really dive into the story, wondering if you can, you know, maybe just give us like a little teaser, like a quick summary of the story, like the why. What was this experience about and why does it matter? Okay. Just in a sentence.
I think
or
it,
two.
It can easily be summed up into the worst day of my professional career.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're in for it.
All right.
We're in for it here, folks. This is buckle your seatbelts. So before we get into that, tell us, if you will, where were you in your personal life at this time? Just help set the stage.
In my personal life? Well, I was 23. So a young Jackie, whose last name wasn't even Chambers yet. Wow. And I was living in Cincinnati. I was living in Cincinnati, Ohio, because that's where the job was. And so I moved down there out of college, not knowing anyone. And it was relatively lonely. It's hard to move to a city without knowing anybody, but certainly was making friends with my coworkers and my teammates within the organization, which was great, but very young, very junior within the team, and terrified is maybe the best way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That definitely sets the stage. We've all been there too, right? We can all remember those times. And so that's very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jackie, let's jump in.
Sure.
Tell us the story, you know?
All right. Well, as I said, it's a young Jackie Chambers, somewhere around 23 years old in, I like to call it kind of cubicle hell. Our office building was in not like the downtown nice part of Cincinnati, but the not nice part of Cincinnati. Like our office was surrounded by barbed wire and there were bullet holes in the Taco Bell across the street. And so that was the locale. You know, sunny Cincinnati. We at the time were struggling as a team with our product offering because we were offering a sale leaseback product. And I won't get too technical about tax equity because nobody really likes me to talk about that. But we had a product. And at the time we had a couple of very large clients. Let's say we had two very large clients and both of them were trending toward a different product, which was the partnership product. And they were looking effectively to monetize more sponsor equity. They wanted more cash flow out of transactions and they wanted to put those projects into yieldcos. That was the ultimate plan. So it was the era of yieldcos. And we were struggling because we did not have regulatory approval to do a partnership flip product. So we had one product that we were offering and it was a challenge. And so we were seeing our client base move away from us. And it was, we were trying to convince them, please don't do that. Our product offering is actually very appealing, right? Very lucrative. I was also working for an individual at the time who was the, let's call him the leader of the group. His name was Dick Rye. And he has since retired. And the story is, I don't know, over a decade old. So I can tell the story now.
Okay.
But I was working for Dick Rye. And I was, as I said, terrified of Dick. We, over time, had a very healthy relationship. He makes me laugh more than most people. But there were days when, you know, I would go to the lunchroom to eat lunch for 15 minutes and come back. And there was a voicemail that said, you better be eating lunch with the fucking CEO. Where are you? Why are you not at your desk? And he wasn't joking. Okay. He meant it. He was very serious. And I'm like, oh shit, you know, like can't go to the bathroom today. Got to be here at the desk. Cause if you missed a call, he would punish you and he would not pick up your phone call when you returned it for the rest of the day. So you were in timeout.
Okay, all right.
So working for this individual who, again, we continue to be very close to this day, but he was very scary and I was very young. And I had been given, let's say, like a 5-pack of smallish utility scale projects to do the financial modeling on. And we didn't often do the full cash flow, right? The revenues and the expenses. Most times that was given to us and then we would put it into our tax equity model. But this time it was one of our largest clients. I would say we were very close to losing them because we didn't have a product that we could offer them that they wanted. And so my responsibility was, Jackie, make the cash flows, put them in the tax equity model. Let's see what we come out with. So I go through, I make all the different models. I put them in, I come out and say, okay, the net proceeds to the seller is about $120 million. So Dick goes forth and he gives them, you know, an indicative range. It says, oh, you know, it's right around $120 million. We've done the analysis. This puts us competitive with a partnership flip product. Like, this is going to be great. Let's get on a phone call. Let's go through all of this together. So we set up a phone call for like the following day with this client's leadership team. And I'm going through the model again, probably about 45 minutes before we're supposed to get on this phone call. And I'm realizing that I accidentally put an escalator that shouldn't have belonged on the PPA rate for, let's say, 3 out of 5 of these small scale utility projects. Mm-hmm. And when I'm doing the pricing, it looks like there is a $20 million mistake in the proceeds. Mm-hmm. So about 20 minutes before the call, I have to pick up and I have to call him. And I call my boss and I say, Dick, like, I really messed up. I made a $20 million mistake and like, I don't know what to do. And he goes, okay. Let me think about this. I'll figure it out. We're still going to get on the phone call with them. It's like, okay. And I'm like, is he going to throw me under the bus? Is this going to be really bad? Like, what is going to happen on this phone call? So we get on the phone and he basically opens it with, hey guys, we're going to need to reschedule this call. Long pause, because we believe that we were hacked by North Korea. And our financial model, we cannot trust the outcomes of our financial model because we believe that we were hacked by North Korea. And oh, this is a publicly traded organization. Okay. But like, these were the days when there was like a lot of news publicity over North Korea's hacking so-and-so. And there's just like silence on the other side of the phone. There were really no follow-up questions, which I was surprised about at the time too, right? I guess it's like, you're going to go in, you're going to go big, and you're just going to be like, yep, it was North Korea. You know, we had nothing to see here. And so he's like, yeah, I don't think the outcome is right. And we're just going to have to reschedule the call. And so the guys on the other side of the phone were like, okay, we'll reschedule the call. And we ended up not getting the business because, yep, in fact, the economics did not work out the way that they were supposed to. And my boss called me after we got off the phone and I was like, he's really going to scream at me. And now this is a man who I still fervently believe he ended up with a paralyzed vocal cord at one point. And I'm pretty sure it was because he had screamed at the team so hard, but that was not this incident. And so he picks up the phone and he calls me and he goes, I'm not going to yell at you. I'm like, oh, thank God. He goes, I'm not going to yell at you because I know that there's nothing that I can say to you that is going to be anything worse than what you're currently saying to yourself and how badly you're currently making yourself feel about the situation. And I was like, that is accurately pegged. That is accurate. Mm-hmm. Yes, correct. But it was very definitively, yeah, I would say that the worst day of my professional career, because I had to own up to a really material mistake to a man that I was abjectly terrified of. And yeah, it was just sort of an interesting experience.
Yep. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Sure.
And as somebody who's presided over more than one model busts, I will say,
yeah,
I feel your pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've definitely been there. And, you know, one of the things that I was wondering about as you're telling the story is, you know, you've run the model, you've kind of come up with the answer, you've told your boss, hey, here's what I think it is. And then you're back in the model later.
Mm-hmm.
Are you double checking? Like, I'm kind of curious about like what the mentality is. What's your mindset to say, I already gave the answer. I already figured this out, but here, I'm going to go back and look again. What caused you to do that?
Fear of failure, probably. I mean, yes, like fear of getting something catastrophically wrong and putting, frankly, money out the door at some point that should not have been sent. And I, in my mind, that is always the worst case scenario. Like, yes, it's very bad, right? When you make a financial modeling mistake and it doesn't look good, but it feels like it's 10 times worse when you actually send money out the door and it's something that should not have gone out the door. But yeah, I mean, I think I've always had a lot of attention to detail and doing that type of financial modeling. And also in those days, and probably still today, there's a fair amount of like 2 a.m. musings. I don't know if that's ever happened to you with the financial model where you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, I did not price the depreciation benefits correctly. I had the wrong depreciation schedule. And it's like, why am I thinking of this?
You just wake up in the middle of the night. Yeah, the next morning, your spouse is mm-hmm. like, why did you just sit up suddenly and shout, depreciation? Yeah, yeah. Like, what was that yeah. about?
And it feels like a dream, but at the same time, 9 times out of 10, when I go back into the model and I look at it again, I'm like, yep, I did in fact make that mistake that I realized so early in those morning hours. Yeah.
Yep. I can relate to that mindset for sure.
There's so much here that would be fun to dive into. I'm like, this boss, what an interesting character. I thought, Jackie, you were going to say, like, that moment where you had to call him afterwards to debrief. I was like thinking of all the permutations of things he could say, like, see, this is why you shouldn't eat lunch, you know, or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that he in that moment, though, you know, found the, you know, some words that, you know, you were already doing the, you know, the hard, you know, hard thinking and beating up yourself. I'm curious, Jackie, going back to that moment where this all happened pretty fast. You caught the mistake, like, not all that long before the phone call. Like, let's just pause in that moment for a bit here. Like, what, if you can remember, I know it was a minute ago now, but what did that feel like? Do you remember what that felt like? Yeah.
I mean, I still get heart palpitations thinking about it. It felt bad, anxiety producing, just real like fight or flight type reflexes of just like, mm-hmm. oh God, you know, like this is really very quite bad. But I think it's those moments before you sort of fess up to having made a mistake that are probably the worst moments. I think once you get it out and kind of admit something's gone sideways here, that you can start problem solving. Not to say we did a lot of problem solving in this moment. He did, but I don't think we generally did a lot of problem solving. But you know, I think once it's that time period before you really say something that's the absolute worst.
The anticipation,
yes, Joel.
Is worse than the realization in this regard. Yeah, that's a that resonates.
Yeah.
That now resonates.
I also do tell this story to the various different youthful individuals who happen to be on my team or working on my, you know, financing stuff, because it's, I think, important for them to know that everybody makes mistakes. Some mistakes are bigger than others. And the most important thing is just to own up to it. Don't try and cover it up. Own up to it. And there's like, honestly, very little that they could do that I haven't already done wrong. So I do try and share that story with them, because it all turns out okay in the end. And we just need to be honest and open about things.
I love that you said that, because I mean, I feel like that's so much of what we're trying to do here, just generally in this podcast, is kind of have people hear stories of others in the industry who've been out there and, you know, lived the challenges, the mistakes, the opportunities, and all that. How do these individuals react when you tell this story?
I don't think they quite know. I've had a variety of reactions. There's like a fair amount of staring. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of staring. And I usually tell it after they maybe made a mistake themselves to make them feel better about it. Mm-hmm. And I have had a couple of people be like, oh, thank you for saying that. Like, thank you for sharing that with me, because it does make me feel better about whatever stupid thing I did. You know, that's most of the reaction that I get is sort of appreciation for embarrassing myself in front of them. Which really I'm not ashamed to do. I'm not afraid to do that.
That is awesome, right? I mean, it really is an act of generosity, right? And it's amazing. It's also an act of leadership, right? If somebody can share that, then maybe somebody else feels a little bit more comfortable doing the same. And yeah, suddenly we don't feel so alone in these decisions, because it is going to be anxiety producing, right? How could it not be? I mean, and I don't know that we'd even want to change that, but part of the human experience. But man, think about all the opportunities where maybe people are just like holding on to that anticipation and not sharing, or sharing later or whatnot. And, you know, so kudos to you for facing up to it and the boss. I still love that North Korea. I'm going to be laughing about that for days. Yeah.
Yep. Just firmly say things and most people won't question you. Yeah, I think that's another lesson learned. That's another lesson learned. But I also, I mean, it was kind of interesting from my perspective that his feedback was that he saw that I was so self-critical that he knew that I was going to beat myself up more than he ever could. And I think in the long term, that's been very, very accurate. And I am very self-critical. And I think that that's been a big motivator in some ways, and that like, I'm never doing enough. It's never enough. And I have to be doing more. And it's kind of interesting to, I think there's some people in your lives or some people who are maybe a little bit more attuned or have some perspective, but like the fact that he was able to look at me after knowing me for about a year and a half and could see like probably my biggest vulnerability and the place that I was probably most sensitive and both like give some, I don't know, grace to that. And I didn't recognize it at the time that being self-critical to the extent that I was like a problem.
That's really interesting, Jackie. Let's unpack that a bit more. It's interesting. I struggle with this too, in terms of self-criticism, and it can be like an ally, right, to a point, because it can push you, you know, that's one way to orient to it. Like, hey, this is in terms of productivity, getting things done, driving you, you know, it can drive, you know, perhaps quality of output at work, you know, by just pushing you to recheck things, right? You know, but there's also like, I think what you're hinting at is like, there's maybe a dark side to it as well, right? And like, how do you think about that trade-off between the pros and cons? Is there a way to keep what's good about it, you know, but like while straining out the bad? I'm curious to hear how you think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've had a couple of roles, probably most recently at NextAmp. The project acquisition role probably played to some of my worst instincts and some of my worst personality traits, which is just like ruthlessly competitive with myself, like both externally and with myself, and just like the ability to constantly push yourself. And there was nobody there saying, no, like, slow down, stop, you're going to burn yourself out, don't do this. It was kind of like a more type mentality. And I didn't in that time period really have the self-governance to be able to stop myself from fully engaging in it and pushing myself too hard and devoting everything to it. But it kind of reached a point in time where I was on the phone with my best friend and she's just like, this was probably like 5 years into project acquisitions. And she goes, you know, I can hear it in your voice when you're winning. I was like, that's messed up. She goes, yeah, I can tell before you even say anything that you're either winning transactions or losing transactions. And that's kind of when I realized that I was a little bit too wrapped up in it. And, you know, my husband had also said things like that to me. But sometimes it takes a little bit of an outside perspective to be able to hold a mirror up and kind of say stop. And so I've been really fortunate over the past year or so here. I've both joined New Energy Equity, which has been a fantastic experience, great team. And they have said no to me in a few instances, like you need to slow down, you're going to burn yourself out. But also I feel like I've sort of turned off the self-pressure or at least really ratcheted it down because I don't think I have anything left to prove. And I don't think I have anything left to prove to myself in terms of needing to just destroy myself to be professionally successful.
So, to the question of sort of the pros and the cons of this kind of internal drive, this kind of relentless determination that, you know, as you're talking about, leads people to burnout. That's kind of like the dark side. It's also a great motivator and leads to success, as you've experienced as well. How have you found that balance?
I haven't. I genuinely haven't. I think what I've done, well, I haven't found a way to both do like project acquisitions in a way that's healthy. So, you know, I ended up, I think it was like last December, I probably did the first real transactions in terms of selling assets that I had in a while. And it was sort of like turning that back on a little bit in terms of the competitiveness, negotiating documents and getting a transaction closed. Because that's a good feeling, right? Like that's a good, successful feeling. When you're selling a project, you're making money for the organization. When you're buying a project, you're keeping people busy within the organization in terms of like job security. Like, you know, like it's a good feeling to close on a transaction. It's a successful feeling. And I could kind of feel the highs coming back again. And I was like, okay, I gotta be careful. Yeah. You know, I gotta be a little bit careful with this. And I just like, I'm trying to self-regulate better. And I think I've gotten myself in a role. Maybe it'd be the balance, Jay, is picking a role that doesn't play to your worst instincts. But I also think you probably end up doing roles that do play to your worst instincts. And that just makes you recognize like what works and what doesn't. And like, I am being self-critical by saying that I haven't found a balance, but in reality, I probably have, but I'm also a little bit like an addict. And I know that if I go back to it, I would, it's hard to control oneself.
Jackie, everything you're saying is resonating big time. And I love the boldness of the statement, I haven't, you know, like, it's not like there's some, like, it's not a destination balance. Like,
yeah, it's a journey.
And I'm there. And I don't know that we would want it that way anyway, right? Like, it'd be a little bit like, wait, like, you get to some, what growth would there be left to be had, right? If you had figured everything out. And I love that confidence in stating I haven't. But also, it's clear just listening to you talk about this that there's been like, maybe despite finding perfect balance in all moments, every day, and all time, it's so clear listening to you that there's been meaningful progress, right? Like these new muscles being formed. Like, okay, you're being more strategic about this, you know, this job selection, job design. Just the self-awareness I'm noticing this feeling again, right? You know, this competitiveness and like something that jumped out at me hearing you talk is kind of the very high degree of self-awareness that to me, you know, is popping out. And if I think about this, like, yeah, I don't know that balance at all times is attainable. I don't think the Dalai Lama would say, you know, that that's like a feasible goal, right? To be balanced at all times, but can we become more self-aware? Seems like you have been, right? Can you become perhaps more balanced at more moments in time? Like, it seems like you've achieved that.
Yeah. Well, I happily, you know, I have my husband and my kids who I think have sort of inspired/required me to like figure this out a little bit better. I think it's very hard. And like when you have kids and you're looking at the kids and you're like, well, but I'm not doing X, Y, and Z thing with you because I'm sitting at the computer and I'm doing this. And the way that I'm trying to live without regrets now, and I'm trying to figure out how can I manage both pieces and how can I sacrifice less on both sides. And I feel like I'm finding some success with that. And it's just, it took me a while. And I think it took me a couple of years into motherhood for me to be a little bit less of a lunatic professionally, because I was also very concerned professionally when I had the kids that I would be, I don't know, on a secondary career track or not able to obtain what I wanted to. And because I had been told that it would be harder to do what I wanted to do professionally with kids.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up that point. You know, could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what it's been like as a woman in this industry? Have you found it harder?
In the earlier days, yes. I think actually it's kind of interesting. It's like when you're a younger woman before you're married or in the earlier days before you have a kid, it's like you kind of feel like a balloon. And in that, like, it feels like your leaders professionally are looking at you and it's like, is this going to pop? Like, is this going to explode? Is this going to pop? Like, is she going to have a kid and leave the workforce? Or are you going to have a kid and are you going to stay in the workforce? And like, it seems like it's sort of a sense of anticipation before you can kind of establish like, yes, like I've had children, but I can also work and I can manage both things at once. And it's actually been easier, or maybe I've been putting less pressure on myself post having kids to demonstrate that I am a functional professional person than before I had kids. Because like I had been asked, you know, before I, in a job interview situation, like, do you intend to have children and leave the workforce? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's also not a legal thing to ask or not an okay thing to ask, but like, mm-hmm. that's happened to me when, you know, I think it was maybe a year into marriage, something like that, before we had kids. And yeah, like that was pretty shitty. And like, that's not the easiest thing to internalize. And like, you know that the male candidates are not being asked that.
I've never been asked that question.
I've never been asked that question.
Good for you guys. Yeah. I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, that's kind of messed up.
And I've found I have a marvelous community of women within the industry. And I mean, you guys remember what this industry looked like, you know, 13, 14 years ago. There were did not feel like there were many of us. And mm-hmm. I still joke about, I was at InfoCast earlier this week, and there were some newer people to the industry being like, wow, you know, like there's a lack of diversity, but it was probably 25% female. And like, I remember being at InfoCast and the photographer for the event followed me around and took my picture. And I was like, sir, like I'm taking meetings now. And he's like, yeah, but you're the only woman here. And like, we need to have different. So like, that's what I remember the early days. And now I'm like, this yeah. is great. You know, like there's more than two of us. I've made some really good relationships of other female professionals within the industry. And they've also had a lot of challenges. I think most of us do. And it's been very cathartic to have that community to kind of fall back on and be able to talk to when like going to a conference and maybe things aren't going so well from a health perspective. And there's like a lot of crap that happens. And it's just, I've been very fortunate with the community that I've been able to build here because they've been endlessly supportive.
Yeah, I think it's another theme that is really important to us in these conversations is like being the full person that you are in your work life, you know, trying to be able to do that. And I mean, you just mentioned, you know, going to a conference and having a health problem or being sick or whatever it is, like,
yeah,
you carry the stuff with you and you try to put it down to like get the work done. But you know, that's hard to do. And it's always there with us, even if we're trying to separate it out for business purposes. It's
still there.
It's still there. It's still there. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing the story with us. Could you wrap it in a bow? You know, is there like a particular lesson that you feel like you've learned or some growth that you took away from this experience that you want to share with the audience?
Great question. Always double check your work. Don't be afraid to say you screwed up, because in all likelihood, your boss has probably screwed up in a more material manner than you have, even though they may not say it. I think that's probably the most inspiring of a message I can muster out of this experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I didn't hear you say was, when in doubt, blame North Korea. So
although
that's not
we should
takeaway.
Have. Although we should have. The believability of the story, you know,
Jackie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun. Always nice to speak with you, Joel. Jay, it was really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. And thank you for sharing the story with us, because I think a lot of people out there have had similar experiences. Anybody who's done any work on financial models, as Joel and I both have, we know there's always a model bust somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just how big and when does it found? So
yeah,
it's always out there.
It's a lot of young folks are running models, right? And it's the first kind of really challenging, you know, but the models have really big implications, as you've covered here, right, Jackie? And so it's the model bust is something that, yeah, like Jay said, Jay's presided over it, Jackie, you have, I have, and it's it's a thing that does happen. And it's a thing that, you know, I'm sure there are people out there right now in the last month who have had a similar type of experience. And so I'll just say it again. I think it's a real act of generosity for you to come here and share.
Thanks for that.
Thank you for joining us on Re-Energize.
If you like what you hear, if you feel your energy rising, please pass this on to your friends.
And hey, you might have a story to share. If that's the case, you can reach out to us using our email address found in our show notes.